Welcome, everyone, to Episode 9 of the Harry Potter Lexicon Podcast. My name is Steve Vander Ark. I'm the creator and the editor-in-chief of the Harry Potter Lexicon website, and I am certainly glad to be back making another podcast. It's been several months since I've had a chance to do this. This is going to happen every so often, I think, and we're just going to have to work with it. I get extremely busy when I'm teaching and just don't have the 4 or 5 hours it takes to put the podcast together, record it, go over it, edit it, things like this. And so I'll do one as often as I can, but unfortunately I think this is going to happen a little more often. I certainly don't want you to think that the podcast is ending. I don't have any particular plans to end this. I enjoy it too much, and I've gotten so much great feedback from people, and I know that people enjoy it and enjoy listening to it, have a lot of comments to make, and I've had people tell me that they just enjoy it so much because it's a chance to just kind of think about the books again and go back to the canon itself. It's interesting because I was this afternoon, right before, in fact, before I started recording, they were doing Prisoner of Azkaban was on ABC Family, and you know we've all seen it, I don't know how many times, and I was watching it again, and we were talking as it came up, and my wife said to me, "So why again is Sirius's face turn up in that crystal ball?" And I said, "Well, you know, he really doesn't in the book. I mean, Harry looks into the crystal ball, and but a lot of that is just things that they added for the film, and Caran added." And it struck me again just how many things in that film. You know, I kind of talk about the big things, but how many little things in there are added, and not that there's anything wrong with that, but how easy it is for us to kind of lose track of what's actually in J.K. Rowling's story, her actual story, and what is kind of things that have been added, things that we now kind of lump together as all part of the same, you know, this is all the Harry Potter universe, but it really isn't. As a matter of fact, it was interesting. I was watching the one of the interviews that's on the new DVD of Deathly Hallows, and she was saying how she had said no when I think Caran wanted to put some little tiny people inside of a instrument or something in the film. And she'd said, "Well, no, why would they be there? What would be the reason for them being there?" Well, the reason that he put so many things into the film was because it's cool, it's fun, it looks neat, it's exciting, it makes a good visual. And that's kind of a good insight into the difference between the canon Harry Potter, which is very carefully crafted. Everything has a meaning. Everything has a purpose. It doesn't have a meaning necessarily. We'll talk about that in a minute. But everything is there because it fits into a very carefully constructed world. And that is what J.K. Rowling works from when she was writing the books. Everything that she does fits into this carefully structured world. Everything follows the rules. And she talks again about those rules that she created back in the beginning of the 1990s when she was creating the stories. Everything fits. When they turn around and turn them into films, everything doesn't fit. And it doesn't have to because they're telling the stories, the basic story, but they're telling them in this new language, which doesn't necessarily fit with all of the rules that Rowling put together for her created world. And so things will happen in the films which don't fit, which don't make sense, which are there for visual effect, which are there for humor. The shrunken heads come to mind. That's there for humor, for the joke, for the funniness of it. And it's funny, and it's great, and I don't care. But that's not the same kind of a world as the one that Rowling created. Rowling's world is very, very carefully controlled, if you will. And those controls are often, you know, broken or they're not there in the film. And so, again, you look at that, you think, what exactly is the canon? Why don't we include the films? I'm not saying that the films are bad when I say that they are not part of the Harry Potter canon. It's interesting. I was on a website, which was a sort of an encyclopedia website, kind of like the Lexicon, and they had references to every room that appears on the Marauder's map, for example, in the film, as if that all was on equal status with things that are in the books. And the problem is, in my opinion, the problem is, if you're, let's say you're writing a fan fiction and you want to include things which are true to the Harry Potter canon. Well, how can that website, how can you discern between what is canon and what isn't when those things are included? And again, this is another place where I am not saying that that's wrong. It's not what we do on the lexicon. It doesn't fit with my way of looking at things, but it is something to be aware of, is that there is a difference between Rowling's created world and other people's interpretations of it, regardless of how much you like those other interpretations, including the films. Now, wow, I got off into a long tangent here before we even hardly got started, but it is interesting. When you listen to the Harry Potter Lexicon podcast, if you go to the Lexicon website, our focus is on the books, on what J.K. Rowling herself put together, her created world. Now, we do include some things which are not from the books directly, and we've talked about this before, but again, we're sticking with her vision, what she has actually specifically come up with. So anyway, off on that tangent, but let's talk a little bit before we go any further. And the reason this came up is, again, I was thinking through the world of Harry Potter. I was thinking through all of the things that have gone on in Harry's world and the years when it happened and the dates when it happened. And again, J.K. Rowling created this originally in the early 90s. That was when she was thinking everything up. And that is actually when the story happens. It happens from about 1991 through 1998. And you can tell, one really clear example is the fact that Dudley gets in trouble for trying to bring along a computer and a video player, and so in the car when they're trying to get away from the letters in book one. Now, when Rowling wrote this, it would have been ridiculous to think of taking a computer along in the car. Now I take a computer along in the car every time I get in the car. It's my phone, but it's got all the functions of a computer and more. I can watch everything from television to anything on this thing. But back when that was written, that would have been ludicrous for Dudley to take along a video player in the car. So you can tell as you read the book in all these little references, you can tell that it was actually created in the early 1990s. And that fits. That is right exactly when the stories are taking place. So just for fun, I was looking at the calendars again. On the Lexicon website, we have a calendar for each one of the books, and we've done our best to try to fit the calendar of the books to the calendar of the year, which doesn't work in some cases because Rowling paid no attention to what days of the week this would have happened or that would have happened. That's not the way she's thinking, but we fans tend to try to look at everything as if it really could really have happened and maybe it really was real. So if we go back to 1992, for example, which is the first book that we have events happening in December, at least at the beginning of December. It's December the 3rd today, which is when I'm recording this. So looking at the beginning of December, what would be happening in 1991 or 1992 in Harry's world, in the storyline? Well, back in the beginning, the first week of December every year, McGonagall walks around and takes the names of the people who are going to stay over at Hogwarts over Christmas. So that happens in book one. That's about the only thing that happens in book one until the actual Christmas. In the second book, it's right at the beginning of December, December 10, as a matter of fact, when Hermione steals supplies from Snape's store cupboard in order for them to make the Polyjuice Potion, which takes a month to brew, so she gets the materials at the beginning of the month, and it isn't until the end of the month that they actually have a finished Polyjuice Potion. And then the next week, on the 17th of December, is the Dueling Club. This is in book two. So if we were going to go back, to 1992, which is about 9 years ago, or 19 years ago. Wow, really? Yeah, could it be? Is it that long ago? I guess it is. 19 years ago, on the 17th of December, is when the Dueling Club happened. 1993, now we're talking Prisoner of Azkaban, of course, the trip to Hogsmeade. Happened. That's when Harry was wearing the invisibility cloak and he snuck in and he heard the backstory about Sirius and his parents. And again, that they did that, include that in the film, which is good because that, again, the whole purpose of books two and three and four to some extent is to give us Harry's backstory, because then we go on to books five, six, and seven where we get Voldemort's backstory. So we're getting the first part of our backstory here. 94, this is Goblet of Fire. This is when Rita Skeeter is poking around and does the interviews with Hagrid on the 11th. And interesting, on the 10th is when McGonagall announces the Yule Ball. But notice there is no dance class in the books. That is completely invented for the film. But that was December 10 when that happened. 1995, December 18, is Cho and Harry have their first kiss. And then, of course, the attack on Mr. Weasley happens that night, and they all end up at St. Mungo's on the next day. 1996, the 19th of December, is when Romilda Vane tries to slip Harry a love potion. That doesn't actually become a problem until March, so 3 months later when Ron accidentally eats one of these three-month-old chocolates. And so that's a problem there. And in 1997, which is Deathly Hallows, Harry and Ron and Hermione are not even at Hogwarts, but on the 20th is when Luna is captured by Death Eaters and the Hogwarts Express. And interesting, because I was thinking about that. That is, Christmas is when that happens. Of course, right after that, they go to Godric's Hollow. If you look at the actual calendar, there's about 3 months. Beginning of September is the last time before that that we have actual dates of anything, which is when they're at Grimmauld Place. It's 3 months where we don't have any real record. We've got a few things that happen, but we have no idea when they happen in that time. And, you know, that's really interesting. Deathly Hallows, there are large chunks of time in that book where we just don't have anything. Deathly Hallows is interesting because it's, in a sense, Rowling had a number of these set pieces, these events that had to happen, the visit to the ministry, the visit to Godric's Hollow, the visit to the Diagon Alley to go into Gringotts and things. And these things are really stretched out, and we don't hear much in between, which just brings me back to my point that I think if she's ever going to write another Harry Potter book, I hope she writes book 7 from the point of view of Luna and Neville and Ginny and all the things that happened at Hogwarts, because you realize that all of what happens in a normal, if you will, Harry Potter book, all of that is going on, and we know nothing about it. We don't hear anything because we're all wandering around going camping for 3 months straight with nothing whatsoever said about all the things that are going on. So just imagine an entire book, book 7B or 7 part 2 or 7 the alternate story, where we would see what goes on at Hogwarts, which would be an entire book in and of itself. Think about Half-Blood Prince, how thick that book is. Well, that'd be the story. So hopefully someday maybe we will get that wonderful, wonderful opportunity to find out all the things that happened at Hogwarts. Okay, let's charge ahead. Let's go into the Harry Potter canon. Couple little comments. Oh, Pottermore, today closed down for a week. I didn't know it was coming. I guess I should have been paying closer attention, but it was closed down for a week for upgrades and things like this. According to what it says on the blog, it's not going to be a big update from the user point of view in terms of a lot of new content, but it is going to be a new some new stuff under the hood, which is good because they decided not to open it up to the general public. I know there have been people emailing me saying, so how do I get on Pottermore? I thought it was supposed to be available. And apparently it's still not available, as in they're going to do some behind-the-scenes work. I suppose it's too much to ask that they're going to be adding sound effects and music. That's what I would like to see. One thing, I know there's been discussion about this online. It's one of these things that I've just kind of had written down with a big question mark. What is 1531 and 4157? Now, if you've been on Pottermore, you know that in the cupboard under the stairs, if you run your mouse up toward the top, there's a little meter of some kind, and probably an electrical meter. I know that when I lived in London, in the cupboard under the stairs, which I had a cupboard under the stairs, there was an electrical meter there. And but when you look at it, it says 1531. If you run your mouse over it, it runs ahead to 4157. Take your mouse off, it goes back to 1531. No idea what those numbers mean. Interesting to look at some of the comments online. People said, you know, it's got to mean something. And this is one quote that kind of made me smile. It said, when did Joe ever do anything random? All Joe's numbers mean something. Well, guys, sorry to tell you, but no. Joe does random things all the time, and all Joe's numbers don't mean something. I remember back when some of the books were out, not all the books. We were in that mindset for a while where absolutely everything had to mean something in the books. And we just, oh man, up, down, left, right, every single thing, we took it apart. We tried to figure out what it meant. We'll talk about more of that in a few minutes when we're talking about Goblet of Fire, because that was where it really kind of reached its climax. And then we realized, and this actually happened, I think, with book five, when she threw in Mark Evans. This was this boy that Dudley apparently beat up. This muggle boy, he beat up a boy by the name of Mark Evans. And, of course, we fans went crazy. Evans, that was Lily's name. It's got to be some sort of connection to Lily. Oh, yeah, there's connections everywhere. And no, there wasn't. She said in an interview, no, it was just came up with a name and stuck it in there. It didn't mean anything. I think that was a bit of a wake-up call for many of us who were analyzing every tiny little thing that she said, every tiny little thing in every book, and the fact that, she maybe wasn't working at quite the complete, utter, detailed depth that we thought she was, and maybe found it all a little bemusing to watch us, take apart every single little comment she made, every single thing she wrote, and try to look for hidden meanings and make connections. And, as it turns out, everything didn't mean something. Everything doesn't mean something. If you go through the Harry Potter books, you're going to discover things that, didn't turn out to mean anything at all. But on the other hand, okay, that's all fine and dandy, but those numbers get affected by the mouse. They wouldn't have to put numbers in there at all. It wasn't like she had to come up with some numbers to stick in there. They're put there on purpose. It changes on purpose. I'd say in this case, they have to mean something. And I don't know what 1531 and 4157 mean, but I have a feeling somewhere along the line we're going to find that out, whether it's going to be some game or some connection or something somewhere. But I've got it written down. I don't know about everybody else, and we can speculate and speculate and speculate. And thank you, Joe, for giving us more stuff to speculate about, because, we spent, when the books were being released, that decade was, I think, one of the most fun things about being a Harry Potter fan was all the speculation and all the guessing and all the trying to figure out stuff. And so thank you for giving us something else to think about, wonder about, ask about, speculate about. We love that stuff. So thank you. Another comment I saw on Pottermore. People were wondering about Nagini, whether Nagini and the boa constrictor in book one were the same snake. And I think that probably some of you are going, no, they can't be. And because they can't. Nagini is has a venomous snake of some kind, because they milk her venom for the potion. And the boa constrictor is definitely not a venomous snake. It is a constrictor. It kills by wrapping its body around its victim and smothering, essentially asphyxiating the victim. Nagini, whatever kind of snake it is, and I have a feeling it's not an actual type of snake so much as a magically enhanced snake of some kind, but Nagini actually poisons its victim and then eats it whole. The boa constrictor eats its prey whole as well, but and we know that because Nagini eats a person at the beginning of book seven. So I've been, I've said this before, kind of going through just for fun, looking at the Harry Potter canon, looking at little details, and I will pick up the lexicon book, the encyclopedia book that I wrote, and just open it up and just kind of find things and talk about them. And last things we were looking at were the letter C, and I think we're into D a little bit. I was looking at D again, and I looked at a couple things. One of them was what makes the dark arts? And the reason that that's important is because, you can say right off the bat, well, the dark arts are, that's magic that gets used for evil. Well, define evil, okay? So, obviously, we're talking. If you're going to define it in terms of evil, you must be defining it in terms of intention. What do you mean to do? Are you trying to be bad, or are you trying to be good? Which is a little bit of a tricky concept. I mean, in some ways, it's obvious. And so, like, we have the unforgivable curses, which, if you use those, man, you are in so much trouble. Except for the fact that Harry uses two of the three. McGonagall uses one. So where's the difference? Why can they use unforgivable curses, and for some reason it must not be dark magic? If it was dark magic, they would be in all sorts of trouble, and they're not. So, you know, intention, I think, turns out, if you think about it, intention must be, has to be, the number one factor of what makes something dark magic. Not the magic itself, not the actual, the spell, not the whatever you're doing, but the intention that you have behind doing it. And there's a lot of examples all through the Harry Potter canon of intention being affecting the magic that is being caused. A good example is if you look at the Shrieking Shack scene at the end of Prisoner of Azkaban, Harry uses an Expelliarmus spell and it actually blasts Snape across the room. Well, Expelliarmus is not an offensive spell. It does not blast anybody anything. All it does is take your wand away. But when Harry uses it on Snape, it blasts him across the room and knocks him out. Well, clearly, Expelliarmus itself is only one part of the picture. There must be something else to this picture for it to be so such an offensive spell, an attack spell, if you will. And clearly the only difference is that Harry has the intention of doing more than just taking Snape's wand away. He's got some emotion involved there. He's got some intention involved there. He's got some negative stuff going on, which causes that spell to actually act almost like an attack spell. And so the fact that something is dark magic or the dark arts, I think we can say that we're talking about intention. We're talking about what is the wizard, what is the intention of the wizard who casts the spell. And it can't just be, I want to hurt someone. Because, you know, I mean, when Harry tries to cast a spells, you know, the inflicting pain on Bellatrix, that's its goal. He wants to hurt her. I mean, that's what he's trying to do. So, is he using dark magic? Well, I don't know. I would say he certainly has the intention of inflicting pain. So, is he a dark wizard? Because he inflicts dark magic. But you remember that, of course, McGonagall, in the very first chapter of the very first book, tells Dumbledore that he's too noble to use, you know, dark magic spells. And he gets all kind of embarrassed. And Flitwick, or excuse me, not Flitwick, but Binns in the second book, when he's talking about dark magic, and so he says that just because a wizard, you know, doesn't use dark magic doesn't mean he can't. And again, I think what we're seeing here is a little bit of a glimpse into why Hogwarts has a Defense Against the Dark Arts class. In some way, yeah, it's a defense against magic cast in a dark magic cast against you. But there's also a sense of that, I think, where Defense Against the Dark Arts is defending you as a wizard from having your magic be dark. Because in life, you are going to encounter situations, perhaps, where you are going to cast magic, which could be, if you do not have the discipline and the moral foundation, if you will, to do it properly, you have the possibility of your magic, regardless of the spell, being dark magic. So when Harry, in Book 3, misused that Expelliarmus spell, let his emotions kick in a sense, he wasn't fully trained yet. Whereas when he is using spells closer to the end of the series, when he's fully trained, and this is an actual term that's used, a fully trained wizard, part of that training is that ability to use whatever magic is necessary with the wisdom, the understanding, the control, and I don't mean control of the magic so much as control of your own emotions, your own intentions, the control to be able to use magical power. Because if you look that, you've got underage wizards, I mean, as in before they even go to Hogwarts, can cast all sorts of magic. Harry apparently could even cast magic, which he didn't actually learn until fourth, fifth year, sixth year. But he cast that kind of magic. The problem is that not whether he has the magical ability, but whether he has the control and the training to use that ability correctly. I mean, in a sense, I guess you can think of it as if you have a child who is you know, kind of a burly kid, maybe. And, yeah, that kid has the ability to tackle and injure another child, but doesn't have the wisdom not to do that and to control those impulses and use them just in appropriate ways. to kind of keep that ability, that strength in a controlled setting. Think about football players who learn to use their aggression, learn to use their physical size, and use it in an appropriate way. I mean, and not to tackle in ways which they're not supposed to, not to injure someone by letting their emotions get a hold of, you know, kind of run away with them. And just recently in the news is a player who had let his emotions run away with him and has been, you know, suspended because he attacked, essentially, a player who was down. You know, those are the kinds of things which Defense Against the Dark Arts is teaching you, how to control your natural ability and to use it correctly. And that doesn't mean use just the right spell words, but also use the right intention, the right emotion, the right feelings. Keep your spell-using ability under control and use it correctly. So it is interesting to think of Defense Against the Dark Arts as a different sort of a class maybe than Transfiguration, Charms, and so, where you're actually just learning spells. You say this and this happens. In Defense Against the Dark Arts, you are using, yeah, you're going to learn some of those spells, but you also are going to use maybe this next level of maturity and of wisdom, which is maybe one reason why Dumbledore didn't want Snape teaching that class. But then who does he get in there? All these complete, you know, buffoons who... we encounter, you know, Lockhart when Harry's in second year, but think about these poor seventh years who are trying to learn Defense Against the Dark Arts, and that's their teacher. You know, that's pretty scary. It's pretty sad, and it's scary because think about those kids who did not get the kind of training, at least that I'm talking about, from a character like Lockhart. So, or for that matter, I mean, you know, I mean, think about all of them except probably Lupin is the only one who is really a good teacher of that kind of thing. But speaking of classes, and now we're jumping back to the letter C. This is actually in my notes, and I don't think we've talked about this, but the different kinds of classes that they teach at Hogwarts. There's I kind of break it up into three basic types. One of them is kind of... I don't have a good name for this one, you know, sociology, social kind of classes, which would be, you know, history of magic, muggle studies, where you're studying the history of your world and things like this, and of muggles, I guess. But then, the kind of more importantly, there's foundation classes, where you learn about things which are the basic underlying knowledge you need, which is astronomy, herbology, care of magical creatures, ancient runes, arithmancy. All of this, you're learning kind of the basic underlying lore and knowledge which you need, and then you have the practical classes like potions, charms, transfiguration, and Defense Against the Dark Arts, where you take that knowledge from those foundation classes and actually learn to use those in kind of structured and more specific ways. So it's interesting when you look at those classes. At first we all kind of think of them all the same, well, they're all just the classes, but they're not. They're actually two different kinds of classes, which makes it a little more logical that they would take something like astronomy. Because you're thinking, what in the world are they using astronomy for? Where's the magic in astronomy? Well, the magic in astronomy is that things like the phases of the moon and positions of this and that affect the, for example, flux weed, which has to be picked at the full moon in order to use it in a polyjuice potion. So those kinds of things. So understanding the magical part, the wizarding part of astronomy is important because it's going to affect how you can do your higher level classes, your potions, your charms, and things like this. Fascinating to think of that. And of course, we can always look at all the classes at Hogwarts and realize that there's a lot of them that are missing. There's things that are missing in there. You know, they don't have classes in things which you think they certainly should, in order to be well-rounded students. And we know from Rowling has said that they're which you might call their elementary education is handled by the parents who do homeschooling. So one has to think that Draco Malfoy, for example, had a tutor and wasn't taught by his mother and his father. But so anyway, let's move on. I always have all these things that I wanted to talk about, but that'll save some of that more letter D stuff maybe for the next time around, because I really want to talk about book four. We've kind of been talking again about each of the books as we go through book one, book two, book three, and now book four. What was the purpose of these books in the overall canon and the overall sort of the scheme of things. We talked about the fact that the first four books create part one of the saga. And so the climax of part one comes at the end of Goblet of Fire. And then the books 5, 6, and 7, of course, are part two. So we're now to the end of part one. What is the purpose of book four? Rowling herself called it the central book in the story. I think she's, you know, that's very clear. I was going to say she's right. Well, of course she's right. It's her series. But so what's the purpose? Well, we've got sort of the surface purpose, which is to finish up the kind of opening story of Voldemort gradually getting stronger, and finally at the end he comes back in his physical form. So that's obviously a very big, huge step in the story right there. So that's one part of the climax. Harry getting himself to the point of being the superhero Harry that we've talked about, and having that dashed when his whole saving people thing, you know, kind of got messed up, where he got captured, and instead of the triumph of winning the Triwizard Tournament, instead everything, all bets are off, everything has changed. The fun and games of both the Quidditch World Cup and the Triwizard Tournament, those fun and games of Book 4 end up with this huge crash as everything falls apart. And of course, we're also seeing a big change here, and this is Dumbledore working behind the scenes to get the Wizarding World kind of all together with this tournament. This is, you know, that's his goal. Why did he suddenly want the Triwizard Tournament? It's because he wants all the wizards from not just the ones in Britain, but the wizards from other schools to kind of all start banding together to work against Voldemort, who one of his big ways of fighting is to get, you know, to promote the enmity between people. And so all of that is happening. Another very important part of this, of what Book 4 is about, is to open Harry's eyes to the realities of this world. And remember, he's been doing that a little bit more and a little bit more in every book. We really get the full blow here in Book 4. We get the, you know, what is the Ministry of Magic like? What is, how does the Wizarding World deal with house elves? All of these things which kind of we open up Harry's eyes a little more, where he sees Britain, the Wizarding Britain, kind of more for what it is, and then also other schools, the fact that there is the kind of worldwide magic. And Rowling followed this up in after Book 4 and before Book 5 with Quidditch Through the Ages and Fantastic Beasts, both of which really fleshed out not only the history of the Harry Potter universe, but also the story of the Ministry of Magic and of sport and all this kind of stuff. All of that really got fleshed out in the first four books, and then in those two books which came after that before Book 5. And so that's a lot of what this is about. But we also have some I don't know, problems, if you will, with Book 4. It's interesting to me that so many people love Book 4, especially people who just see the films, because I can see it. It's an action adventure story. It's got the games. It's got the fun stuff. A lot of humor. It's really just a ripping good story. Yeah, but let's look at it a little more closely. After you kind of get past the initial thrill, if you will, if you look at it, there's some real questions about this book, about the plot. Rowling herself said that she had a real problem in the writing of this book, and at the time she was coming out with one book every year. 97 was the first one, 98 was the second one, 99 was the third one, 2000 was the fourth one, and it was at this point that she basically realized she cannot keep up this pace. Partly because of just making sure that everything keeps fitting together, I think. I think at the same time, because Harry Potter was becoming so huge. I mean, remember, Book 4 was the first time that there was a book release party. I mean, Book 3 just came out, went down to the store, there it sat. There was no big, huge release parties, at least not that I was aware of, for Book 3. Book 4 was when all that started. And so responsibilities as an author and as a curator, if you will, of this world that she was creating, those responsibilities really grew after Book 3 and with Book 4. And I think that was one of the reasons why there was this big gap. But she said herself that, and this is a quote actually from an interview that she did in 2000, she said, Book four nearly caused me a nervous breakdown because for the first time ever, I lost my careful plot which I had had since 1994. I really should have gone through it with a fine-tooth comb before I started writing, and I didn't. I had a false sense of security because all my other plans had held up so well, so I sailed straight into the writing of four, having just finished Azkaban. I had written what I thought at the time was half the book, turns out now to have been about a third of the book, and I realized there was this big hole in the middle of the plot, and I had to go back and unpick and redo. Now, if you think about it, okay, that means a third of the way through the book is with the beginning of the a Triwizard Tournament itself. So if she's having, if she gets to this point and she says, oh dear, I've got a problem. So if we look back and think, okay, what problem did she have? Well, we don't know. She's never told us what that problem was and what she had to do to fix it. Hoping very much that when Pottermore reaches books 3 and 4 and things like this, we're going to get some more information about what specifically it was. But being as we are fans who like to pick things apart, we kind of look at it and try to guess and try to think, okay, what happened here? What doesn't work? What may have been sort of cobbled together to try to cover up a plot hole, for example? And there are some problems with it. I mean, for example, the whole character of Barty Crouch Jr. If Barty Crouch Jr., if the timeline that she gives is correct, he was put into Azkaban 17 years old, right out of Hogwarts. So he's just he's not some, you know, highly trained wizard. He went into Azkaban, was released from Azkaban, but was completely under house arrest, essentially, had no opportunity to go anywhere, to see anyone, to learn anything, and yet, when he is impersonating Moody, not only can he impersonate Moody so well that one of Moody's best friends, Dumbledore, doesn't notice that it's not the right guy, and not only that, but he knows this incredibly powerful magic. He can, you know, fool the Goblet of Fire, which takes, you know, an immense amount of magical power. Where in the world did he learn all this dark magic? All this, you know, you can say, well, he learned it from Voldemort. Remember, he's not been with Voldemort, okay? That's in the book. He's hanging around. I mean, in the movie, he's in with Voldemort and with Wormtail in the opening scene. In Little Hangleton, that's not in the books. He has no connection. He has no way that he could have learned this all from Voldemort. So how in the world can he do this? How can he impersonate Moody for all that time? And you think, well, you know, he looks like him. Yeah, okay, they all know Polyjuice Potion exists. If you're in this world, you know that there is such a thing as Polyjuice Potion. You're not automatically going to just accept everything, anyone, at face value. I mean, you're not going to always be thinking somebody is somebody else, but, you know, you're going to, over the course of a year, a few things here and there might make you wonder. And, you know, Dumbledore just never cottons on to the fact that this guy is not his dear friend, Mad-Eye Moody. And so, you know, it doesn't work in a way. But, okay, let's go with that. Let's just assume that somehow that works out. But then why this elaborate plot? Why an entire year's worth of trouble to try to get Harry Potter to touch a portkey to go to Little Hangleton? Okay, why all of this, you know, imagine, you know, incredibly complex charade to do this? Why would he have to do that? I mean, why didn't he just turn Harry's pillow into a portkey? I think somebody put that on one of the comments way back when, you know, the book came out. People were saying, what in the world? Why didn't he turn Harry's pillow into a portkey? That's a really good point. He could have just done that. He could have handed him something. I mean, Harry trusted him. He could have handed him something. They could have got this all done, you know, an hour, 2 hours, 5 hours after Moody got to Hogwarts. Why this elaborate and highly complicated and fraught to failure, you know, charade to try to get Harry to go to Little Hangleton, so that it doesn't make sense. And so, again, you're looking at a situation where I don't think that in her original plot that Mad-Eye Moody was supposed to be Barty Crouch Jr., that they were supposed to be the same person. I think that and again, this is all my speculation. Please, I know nothing. I don't have any inside information. But I'm just wondering whether maybe she said one of her ways of fixing her plot error was saying, okay, these have got to be the same person then, because I'm starting, well, how about if I just have them using Polyjuice Potion? Boom, there we go. So maybe that was it. I don't know. But we do know some things that kind of some lingering details. There is a line actually left in the book, which is part of the old plot, which doesn't make any sense at this point. The line is when, this is way back in Little Hangleton, when Voldemort says to Wormtail, "Come, Wormtail, one more death, and our path to Harry Potter is clear." Well, there's not another death. I mean, this is left over from the old plot from the book, and there is no real way to connect that to what actually happened. So, that's an example. Another thing is, this is something which is no longer in there, but this is, if you've read on Rowling's website, she talks a lot about this missing character, this Weasley cousin that was going to turn up, which is by the name of Mafalda, who is this daughter of the second cousin, the cousin who's a stockholder or stock, excuse me, stockholder, stock, stockbroker or whatever that Ron refers to in book one, and she's this obnoxious person who is supposed to give, because she's such a know-it-all, she's kind of the anti-Hermione in a way, she was supposed to be giving information to the kids so that they had more information about what was going on, because she knew so much. Well, it turns out that Rowling ended up getting rid of her and kind of turned that character into Rita Skeeter. Because Rita Skeeter would have had better access to actual information, I guess. So that all got changed. So that's something we know is missing, got taken out. But even so, obviously, we know very, very little about what actually happened in this original plot. And we can only hope that somewhere along the line, we might actually get some more information about that. Pottermore is the obvious place. So when we get to book four, which will be, 4 years from now, we're all hoping that maybe we can learn a little bit more about this. A couple little tiny details, things that don't make sense or that I, kind of laugh at or wonder about. The tournament. So this big, huge, wonderful tournament that's supposed to be happening. What is the big thrill? I mean, you realize that aside from the first task, none of these spectators can see anything. They can't see what goes on under the lake. They just sit there. Okay, everybody goes, jumps in the lake, and there they sit for an hour. Nothing. They have no idea what's going on. They can't see anything. And you say, oh, maybe there was some magical way of seeing. Well, no, if there was, then Dumbledore would not have had to have a discussion with Mercus, the head of the Merpeople, to find out what had happened to Harry, and therefore allow him to get points. So, no, nobody could see anything. There they sat. So it doesn't make sense. I mean, and for this, they gave up Quidditch, for example. And the maze, same thing. They can't see into the maze. They don't know what was going on. So after the whole opening thing, they're all sitting there on the stands watching, and nothing. There they sit, just kind of watching the outside of the maze, wondering who somebody might come out of it. That's about all they know. So, things like that are, they sound really great, and they look great on film, but don't quite work out the way that would seem like it'd be worth giving up Quidditch for the entire year, and everybody getting so excited about the Triwizard Tournament, and hardly anybody's actually involved. Only two of the Hogwarts students, of the students of Beauxbatons and Durmstrang, only a handful of each of their students even got to be there. Most of them were back at their school, so they saw nothing at all. They weren't even involved. So it really wasn't. It doesn't seem like quite the big deal that it should have been. But, again, it's, so what? It's a story, okay? Right, it's a story. But just kind of wondering, what was the big deal? Why were they getting so excited? Little things like the spell Enervate, Enervate, got changed in the 2004 updates to the books and is now Renervate, Rennervate, which kind of disappointed me a little bit. Enervate, people were saying, to use that doesn't make sense because, it kind of means that the opposite of what it's supposed to be, which is to, get you kind of, have you recover from a stun. And, that actually would mean that you would be stunned. But see, that's not true. If it was Enervate, Enervate, that's exactly right. It would mean to be stunned. But if it's E-N-E-R-V-A-T-E, which is the way it was spelled, it actually means to end nerve, to give nerve, as in bravery, as in audacity, to give nerve. So it actually works. But they just kind of, people were confused, and so they changed it to renovate. To me, it'll always be enervate. It's kind of what's in my brain, and that's the way I'll always hear it. Another thing is, I guess, the Mrs. Weasley, I have to say, I know that she's written in some ways as a little bit cartoony sometimes, but this whole thing about her buying into what she reads about Hermione, you know, hurting Harry, and therefore she, you know, treats Hermione poorly, and so, come on, Mrs. Weasley, it hurts my impression of her that she would do that, in the same way that I don't like the impression I have of her getting so excited about Lockhart in book two. It's like it paints her as being sort of so silly, you know, just silly. And then, you know, in book five, she's just kind of crabby all the time, and all she is kind of like a housekeeper, and I'm just always a little disappointed with the way that Mrs. Weasley comes across. And I know at the end she kind of redeems herself with Bellatrix, but I kind of wish all the way through that she didn't have these moments where I kind of go, oh, and this is one of them. And when she buys into Rita Skeeter's, what Rita Skeeter writes about Hermione and Harry. And so, but anyway, I mean, beside that, I do really love the book. I really do. It's not my favorite, but it is certainly a book that I absolutely, absolutely enjoy. We keep going and going on this. There's so much to this book, isn't there? This was the first really thick one. I remember when it came out, the number of pages here was almost like matched the number of pages in the first three books. And here I was doing the lexicon, and, you know, I had all the details from books one, two, and three, and it had taken me, you know, a year to do that. And then the book four comes out, and like, oh my goodness, what am I going to do? All this stuff. And then, of course, a big shock when book five came out. But I remember that tucking into book four, and one of the things that we spotted right away was that in book four, there are two Mondays in a row. September 1 and September 2 are both Mondays. And, you know, it's so funny because this is just an example. I talked about the way that we fans at that time were just seeing everything as meaning something and as being deep. You know, what is she saying? What does that mean? And I remember we were saying that, you know, well, in the Wizarding World, you know, regardless of what day it is that you come to Hogwarts on September 1, on September 2, when the classes start, it's always a Monday. And so we had all this worked out. We did the same thing with the wand order problem at the end of book four, which, you know, in the first book, in the first edition of the book, Harry's dad came out first out of the wand, and then his mom came out at the end, which, you know, turned out to be wrong because they're supposed to come out in the reverse order from when they got killed, and so the last one to get out had to be, his mom came out, anyway, it came out wrong. And so then they had to fix that in subsequent editions of the book. Well, before they fixed it, oh man, we speculated so much. Okay, if the wand order is correct that in the spell, that would mean that, oh, okay, so James actually did not die before Lily. So what happened? How did that work out? And we had all this elaborate plans of what she was trying to suggest. What were the hints? Because, you know, again, everything meant something. We had it all worked out. And then, of course, they fixed it all out, saying it was just a mistake, and they fixed it later. And so, you know, that the fact that the two Mondays and the text edits in 2004, they fixed that. All these things that we thought meant something, that we had worked out, and the details, everything means something, you know, has to mean something. It all fits. Now, as it turns out, it's simply possible sometimes that there were mistakes, or that things got in there just kind of randomly and by accident and don't mean anything. So that was an interesting thing. I remember when book four came out. What a rush to read that book and to see we were still getting more questions than answers at this point, but we were starting to see things come together, starting to get a hint of all that was coming up, you know, at the end when they got sent off to pull together the old crowd, and we're wondering who the old crowd was, and all these things, and, you know, the story was getting exciting, and what was going to happen, and there was going to be this war coming up, and, you know, some of these philosophical kind of comments being made at the end about Cedric and about the war coming, and we'll face it when it comes, and oh, man, it was exciting. And, you know, it's funny because and I was a librarian at the time, and it was after Book 4 came out that I had my first real encounter with book banners, people who wanted to ban the books. And as a matter of fact, I was a librarian. We had all four books in the library, and I had about a year-long or half a year-long running confrontation with a group of people who wanted the Book 4 taken out of my library because of how, you know, frightening it was and how gross it was, and, you know, the whole terribly horrific stuff happening at the end when Voldemort was recreated out of that cauldron. And oh man, I can remember the frustration with people who you know, had a problem with the books, which I don't have a problem with. If you have a problem with those books, I don't have a problem with that. That's fine. You are entitled to your opinion. You are entitled to make a decision for your family, for yourself, for your kids. I mean, you are responsible for making what you see as good decisions for your kids. I support that. But then to try to turn that into, and I'm going to make the decision for everybody else, that was a shock. And to have to deal with that and to try to come up with cogent arguments of why, what was the value of fantasy literature? What was the value of this kind of a book? Maybe not to you, but to other people. Why would this be a valid thing to have on a bookshelf for people who want to read it? And that was probably a very... I guess I'm glad now, looking back, that I went through it, because of how much I learned, how much I've come to understand that point of view so much better, and in some ways respect it. Certainly don't respect the idea that you can tell other people what to do, but respect what their concerns, what the concern of someone who looks at that and goes, wow, I don't know, my child is 8, do I want them to read this? You know, I don't know if I want an 8-year-old to read some of that kind of stuff, and there has to be a good decision made. But it seems to me that every 8-year-old is different, and you can't make that decision for all 8-year-olds in one fell swoop. And that was an argument which I kind of knew instinctively, had instinctively inside of me, but I had to turn around and put that into clear language and understand. And, you know, you can't have a discussion with someone without trying to understand their point of view, even if you don't hold their point of view. And I think it was very good in that way for me to understand different points of view on something like this, especially because back then, more so than now, that was a very important part of the Harry Potter experience for those of us that were kind of on the forefront of Harry Potter fandom and of things like this. We had to deal with these questions. When I would do interviews with news media, I would frequently be asked questions like that. Well, what do you think of this? And to be able to answer in a clear way that gave a clear point of view, and not just, you know, sound like, you know, just sort of angry and nasty, but just to say in a clear way kind of how I approached something like that, I think was very important. I think it's important as somebody who gets interviewed by the media to have that kind of answer ready and to have thought that all through. I mean, I was on one radio show. The whole point was I was on the radio show along with somebody who was, as I recall, a pastor, but somebody who was very anti-Harry Potter, and he and I had a conversation. And, you know, it was. I'm glad that when I had that conversation, I had been through the half of a year from hell that I'd been through, so that I did have a clear point of view and an ability to say what I needed to say. And I didn't think I convinced him of anything. He certainly didn't convince me, but to be able to talk intelligently, to be able to talk and discuss and not just sound a little crazy and to say, well, I like Harry Potter, but to actually say, but, you know, here's why these books have a good message, why they have a lot to say in a good way, why they are actually strongly promoting good morals, even going so far as to say a religious kind of point of view. And I have to be very careful not to put too much into that, but you know, there certainly is the philosophy that comes out and is supported by the books. That philosophy is certainly a positive moral philosophy. It certainly is not a you know, dark magic and evil stuff is all great and let's just play around with you know, that's just not the message that these books give. So it's interesting. That really started with Goblet of Fire. That really was where that really kind of came to a forefront, and where I had to face that personally and fight that battle, if you will. So, you know, it's interesting to have been on the front lines of that battle against people who would ban the Harry Potter books simply because they had magic in them. It was an interesting experience, and I carry that with me even now, I guess. People will say, you know, what's it mean to you that you've been part of this Harry Potter community for 12 years and that you've been somebody that has, well, had some media exposure and things like this? And I think, well, in some ways, it's great to be able to do some of the things I've been able to do, and then to share those with fans at the conventions, here in this podcast, in the Lexicon, and all these places, to be able to share some of that in the books that I've written, to be able to share some of what I've learned and what I've come up with, but also to be a voice, I guess, a little bit, not to put too, you know, high a position to it, but, you know, if you're going to get asked those questions, if people are going to say to you, you know, what do you have to say about people who want to ban Harry Potter, and suddenly you're the one who has to say something and has to kind of give the point of view for the Harry Potter community to people who are, not, I guess, not part of the fan community and are looking at it kind of bemusedly and saying, wow, what are those people all dressing up like witches and wizards and playing with their little wands for? You know, so it has been an interesting experience. It's been an honor. It's been a responsibility in some ways, and it's been nothing but a pleasure too. Wow, these podcasts are getting longer. I'm almost up to an hour here. I'm sure nobody will complain too loudly. I know that I've had some nice reviews on iTunes, which, you know, I've heard people say this on podcasts that I listen to, saying thank you for the reviews on iTunes. You know, it really does make a difference. If you say a few nice words on iTunes, people do read those things. I read them when I choose a podcast to listen to. I read the reviews. I find out what people are saying, and I've had a few people saying such nice things about this podcast, and thank you for that. Thank you for you know, giving your point of view on that, and I'm glad that you find it interesting. To me, I guess partly just because, yeah, it's been 12 years, and I've been spending so much time with Harry Potter and looking into it and understanding it, and as I said, being part of this community, being in some ways having a voice in this community, in some ways being somebody who people ask questions of and look to for information, and I have so much to give, you know, in that way. And it's such a great thing to do this podcast and to make that available. So I'm afraid that's about it now for episode 9, but there will be more episodes. This is not ending, and it may be, you know, may have to wait till the Christmas break for me to do the next one. If so, so be it, but there will be more. These are not going to end. I will keep up with them. Certainly have not run out of stuff to talk about. Thanks again to Harry and the Potters for letting me use their music. If you want to go to the Harry Potter Lexicon website, it's at www.hp-lexicon.org. If you're interested at all in the books that I've written, you can find them on Amazon. You can also contact me directly. I have copies. I can sign them for you. If you want a signed edition, let me know. You can contact me on steve.lexicon@gmail.com. I'd be happy to work out things with you. There's an electronic version of the new book that I wrote, which is The Reader's Guide to Philosopher's Stone. That's on Amazon. It's on Kindle. I was looking into putting it on the Kobe, but I'm not sure if I'm going to be able to. Their requirements are a bit pricey, and since this isn't really a big money-making effort, it's just sort of, you know, basically, I just put a price on it to cover the time that I have to put into it and things like this. But, you know, there isn't a huge income at all here. And so I don't know if I can spend the hundreds of dollars it would take to get it onto that platform. So I'll keep looking into it. It's not completely out of the question. But for now, anyway, I don't know that that's going to happen. Again, there's show notes available on the Lexicon website. You can follow me on Twitter, Lexicon_Steve. You can look around on Facebook. There's a fan page there. I'll put the link on the show notes. And I'm working on the second of the reader's guides. That'll be coming out hopefully Christmas break. I've got most of it written. I just am doing a lot of editing, just because every time I edit, I find new things to add and read some things over and go, what in the world was I trying to say here? but anyway, so that about wraps it up for episode 9. Look forward to doing episode 10 soon. I don't know if we'll talk about book five or if we'll spend a little time on the two school books. I think we might do that. But in the meantime, this is Steve Vandrark of the Harry Potter Lexicon, and thanks for listening.